We need to distribute our assets, and we need to have them in the region when the conflict starts.
The new U.S. Secretary of Defense is in Asia. It's Monday, August 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, trade is becoming strained in several parts of Asia. The U.S. sends a new ambassador to the United Nations. Pakistan mongoes, adopting pets, and the future of spaceflight. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper is crisscrossing the Asia-Pacific region on his first international trip as head of the Defense Department. The trip began as the U.S. withdrew from a decades-old arms control pact with Russia, the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The withdrawal means Washington and Moscow are free to develop ground-based missiles with a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers, and that could be bad news for a country that has never even been in a part of the pact, China. Our VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with Esper and explains why.
New Defense Secretary Mark Esper said he wants to see American ground-based intermediate-range missiles in Asia, missiles that, until Friday, were prohibited.
Yes, I would like to, but let's be clear, I'm talking about conventional weapons.
The deployment would strengthen the U.S. position against a top military competitor, China.
Because we've been talking about this for some time now. And they have, I want to say that 80% plus of their inventory is INF range systems. So it's why that shouldn't surprise them that we would want to have a like capability.
Experts say that in the event of a conflict with China, the more military capabilities the United States already has in the Asia Pacific, the better.
We need to distribute our assets, and we need to have them in the region when the conflict starts. The idea that we're going to spend, like we did in the first Gulf War, weeks or months, you know, sending large cargo aircraft and cargo vessels across the ocean to get in the conflict, they'll never arrive.
Esper's arrival Saturday in Australia came just 2 days after North Korea conducted its third missile test in less than 2 weeks, firing what appeared to be short-range ballistic missiles capable of reaching Seoul or Tokyo.
The United States have those bases in Japan, which would be in the flight pattern of some of those rockets that are being tested. And so this is a real deliberate threat.
Esper downplayed the threat Saturday, telling reporters the situation with North Korea is still far more stable than it was just a couple of years ago, when Pyongyang conducted 17 missile tests, including the test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Carla Babb, VOA News, Sydney.
Meanwhile, Hong Kong protests devolved into violence for a second consecutive night Sunday, with police firing tear gas to disperse demonstrators who threw rocks and bricks at a police station. Hundreds of masked demonstrators threw rocks and bricks, smashing windows. Police responded with tear gas to drive back the crowd. The marches are to protest what the demonstrators see as Beijing's growing control over Hong Kong, the officially autonomous Chinese territory. In an ominous warning Sunday, a major Chinese news outlet warned that Beijing will not let the protests continue. We invite you to stay on top of details as we continue to follow developments on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit VOAnews.com. New U.S. defense chief slams China on first Asian visit. 25 dead, 55 rescued after boats capsize in Philippines. Hong Kong protesters refine tactics amid latest violence. China media to Hong Kong protesters, Beijing's patience is wearing thin. Physical and sexual violence against children surging in Indonesia. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Japan has removed South Korea from a list of its preferred trading partners, a major escalation in a trade dispute rooted in historical tensions. The move has far-reaching impacts, as VOA's William Gallo reports from Seoul.
Japan's decision will make it harder for South Korea to buy a wide range of sensitive Japanese products that can have military uses. Last month, Japan restricted exports of high-tech materials to South Korea. Taken together, the moves represent a serious threat to South Korea's economy. Japan's moves are widely seen as retaliation for recent South Korean court rulings ordering Japanese companies to compensate Koreans who were forced to work during Japan's colonial occupation of Korea. South Korean President Moon Jae-in called the Japanese move selfish and a grave challenge to Korea-Japan relations. A trade war between Japan and South Korea could threaten global technology supply chains. South Korea produces 70% of the world's memory chips. The move could also hamper U.S. efforts to present a unified front to challenges like North Korea and China. The trade dispute has prompted a public backlash in South Korea, with customers boycotting a wide range of Japanese products. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Simmering trade tensions between the United States and India have heated up as Washington presses India to lower tariffs and give more access to its market. The U.S. has scrapped trade privileges that allow imports of over $6 billion worth of goods from India with lower or zero duties under a program known as the Generalized System of Preferences. Anjana Pasricha visited one of the beneficiaries of the GSP program on the outskirts of New Delhi to see how businesses have been affected by the trade dispute.
Since it began exporting leather gloves more than three decades ago, business has boomed at this leather goods factory in Faridabad. Alpine Apparels has diversified into accessories such as handbags, belts, and jackets, some inspired by Indian craft. Many of them are destined for top brands in the United States. But Sanjay Likha fears that his family-owned business could be hit after the U.S. scrapped concessional tariffs for these products. Buyers will want him to lower prices to compensate for the higher duties.
It's not easy because the margins have never really been built in to handle an additional 4 to 10% reduction in cost. In case we are unable to make the reductions, and in case the customers are not able to absorb the increased landed costs, it would only mean that the business could shift to some countries which still enjoy the GSP benefits.
That may not be good news for the 1,000 plus workers busy putting together bags and other goods here.
A loss of business obviously means a loss of jobs, a loss of livelihood to the many people that industries like us employ. So it is a situation which is worrying.
New Delhi has retaliated to the U.S. move by raising tariffs on American imports such as apples, almonds and walnuts. Export industry representatives say the deepening trade spat is impacting labor-intensive industries such as leather and gems and jewelry, for which the U.S. was their biggest market.
If industry is going to lose the U.S. market, whether they will gain in some other market or they will concentrate on domestic market, is an issue. So from that perspective, I think for a very limited products line, we may have to look into how these companies can be given some kind of handholding so that they continue in business, they continue to provide employment in the country.
That is the challenge facing companies like Alpine Apparels, to ensure that these handbags, belts and jackets maintain their place in U.S. stores. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Faridabad, India.
Happening now in Asia, Thai authorities are casting suspicion on southern separatists while suggesting broader political motives for a series of bombings that shook Bangkok during a summit of top diplomats from the United States and China and the region. The blasts hit five locations across Bangkok, injuring four people. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's a brand new week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Kentucky native Kelly Knight Craft will be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations after winning confirmation by a slim majority in the Senate this past week. Some Democrats complained about her lack of foreign policy experience going into a senior diplomatic post. We wanted to give you a sense of who is the new U.S. ambassador to the U.N., so VOA's U.N. correspondent Margaret Bashir tells us more.
Craft is a third-generation Kentuckian, the granddaughter of tobacco farmers and a former businesswoman. She and her husband Joe, a billionaire coal executive, are well-known in Republican circles as major donors, having contributed to several Senate campaigns and donating $1 million to Trump's 2016 presidential run. Trump appointed her as his envoy to Canada less than 2 years ago. Her tenure there was marked by the negotiations for the new U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement. Other than that brief posting, she has no foreign policy experience, a point Democratic senators seized on at her June confirmation hearing.
So, Madam Ambassador, let me be frank. I have deep reservations about your lack of qualifications for such a complex and challenging role. Historically, U.S. ambassadors to the U.N. have brought significant executive experience or experience working directly in foreign policy.
Menendez also questioned her extensive absences from her post in Canada, more than half of her 608 days on the job.
I find this staggering amount of time away from posts very troubling and an abdication of leadership.
Despite criticism, longtime UN observer Richard Gowan tells VOA that Kraft can likely handle the job.
Kraft doesn't have a strong history in multilateral diplomacy, but that was also true of her predecessor, Nikki Haley. And I think expectations for Kraft are low, but actually she may be able to win friends amongst U.S. allies at the U.N. if she's willing to work in a collegial fashion.
One of the U.N.'s top priorities is slowing global warming. Kraft has come under scrutiny for her views on climate change. Her family has ties to the coal industry, and she once told a Canadian interviewer that she believes both sides of the climate debate.
Climate change needs to be addressed as it poses real risk to our planet. Human behavior has contributed to the changing climate, let there be no doubt. I will take this matter seriously, and if confirmed, I will be an advocate for all countries to do their part in addressing climate change.
As President Kraft Trump replaces Nikki Haley, who quit the post 7 months ago. Haley held cabinet rank, which Kraft will not, and cultivated a high political profile. Analysts say Kraft is likely to have a more limited role than Haley in setting U.S. foreign policy. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Coming up, Asian mangoes are plentiful, yet hard to find. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Rescuers plucked more bodies from rough seas where three ferry boats capsized after being buffeted by fierce wind and waves off two central Philippine provinces. Police say that the death toll has risen to 25, with six missing. 55 other passengers and crew were rescued. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the mango is indigenous to India and Pakistan, but the United States gets most of its supply from Central and South America. In fact, it's hard to find Pakistani and Indian mangoes in the United States, even though the region produces nearly 40% of the world's supply. VOA's Adsara Khalid tried to find out why.
Most mangoes in the U.S. come from Latin America. Fans of Pakistani mangoes that come in all kinds of varieties and flavors are always on the lookout for their favorite kinds.
When people hear that Multan's Sindri, Langra and Chaunsa mangoes come in, they make reservations early. They wait to hear when Pakistani mangoes will arrive.
Mangoes from Pakistan are hard to find in the United States, even though they are indigenous to that country and a big cash crop. Part of the reason is that trade deals have only allowed their imports into the US since 2011. But the bigger problem is that it's expensive to import.
The produce and packaging costs 30%, whereas 70% is freight and repackaging. We need a cheaper solution because it costs 180 rupees to ship 1 kilogram of mango.
US importers are working with Pakistani producers and exporters to reduce the cost. Ryan Hollingsworth runs a facility for U.S. Department of Agriculture and provides exporters with packaging and distribution services.
Working with the capacity issues, we've been able to get the freight numbers down a bit.
The other problem is that Pakistani mangoes can't be sold in the United States until they have undergone irradiation treatment. This Mississippi plant is one of the places where imported fruit is irradiated.
It requires to be irradiated. And it requires to be monitored by APHIS at this point in time. The regulations require that. And they are irradiated to sterilize any pests, such as the primary pest of concern is fruit fly.
There are irradiation facilities in Pakistan, but they are not approved by U.S. regulators. And doing the irradiation in the U.S. raises import costs even further, but increases their shelf life.
Generally, on Pakistani mangoes, they have a very high brick or sugar count. Those have a tendency to ripen and swell faster. So although in a lot of different products we do get a rather long shelf life extension, with Pakistani mangoes we tend to get 4 to 5 days extra.
The bottom line is that if you are a Pakistani mango eater, you'll have to pay about 2 to 3 times more than mangoes from other importers. But for the mango lovers living in the U.S., it's worth it. Asadullah Khalid, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. Hong Kong marchers staged sometimes violent protests on multiple fronts late Sunday, introducing their latest tactic to evade riot police and tear gas as the demonstrations against a controversial extradition bill entered their 9th consecutive week. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, every year Americans adopt more than 3 million cats and dogs. Most of these pets are adopted from animal shelters, where they were taken after being picked up as stray animals or given up by owners who could no longer take care of them. Kristina Shevchenko visited a shelter in Los Angeles to get a look inside, meet some of the animal caretakers, and understand the adoption process. Anne Rice narrates her story.
It is rarely quiet in this animal shelter in western Los Angeles. More than 200 cats and dogs live under the shelter's roof.
Anytime a dog gets lost or a cat gets lost, we're the place where people will bring the animals to hopefully get them reunited with their owners. And if for some reason an owner can't keep their animal, this is where they would bring them.
Every day, more than 100 people come here looking for a pet to adopt. They are met by volunteers who feed, walk, and play with the animals.
I started volunteering here after I lost my dog. So, yeah, he passed away, and I still want to interact with dogs, but it's a lot of responsibility to own one, so.
If a visitor likes a certain dog or cat, the shelter has special rooms where people and pets can play and get to know each other.
We do what we call adoption counseling, so we try to find out the person's lifestyle and whether or not the animal that they've selected is an appropriate fit for their lifestyle.
Shelters are not the only place where people can find a pet to adopt. Every year, San Diego holds a special animal expo where shelters and animal rescue groups bring dogs and cats looking for a home. Volunteers bring animals to the West LA Animal Shelter not just from the Los Angeles area, but from neighboring Mexico, where the issue of stray dogs is a major one. And this dog was brought to California from Iran.
One of his legs was zip-tied to something, and they had to remove it because it was damaged. But he's 8 months old, super social, super sweet, just a cuddle bug.
More than 120 animals get adopted after such expos. To adopt an animal, the new owner needs to fill in a few forms and pay a fee to cover the vaccinations and neutering. Sandra and her sons came here to adopt one dog, but are coming home with two instead. Although she will be responsible for their care, Sandra says she hopes that adopting an animal will teach her children compassion and responsibility.
We were looking for one dog, but since they're a bonded pair, we decided to take both of them together. I've got two boys, and I think that it worked out great because, you know, we'll have one pup for each one.
More and more Americans are choosing adoption over buying a pet because they know it's a win-win. They get a devoted friend, and a dog or cat gets a second chance at life. For Christina Shevchenko in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
The recent 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing celebrated the crowning achievement in crewed spaceflight, but it also reminded the public that NASA, or the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, is not currently sending astronauts into space from the United States. As VOA's Kane Fairball reports, if everything goes according to NASA's plan, that's all about to change.
What looks like an unusual giant metal canister, rising high above the windy Alabama landscape, has some familiar design features.
So there's a lot of heritage shuttle technology here.
But this is not intended to return the iconic fixed-wing reusable space shuttle into orbit. It was retired in 2011. Last time NASA sent an astronaut into space from the U.S. What is taking shape today at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center is the core of a new Space Launch System, or SLS.
The piece behind me is the liquid hydrogen tank.
Mike Nichols is one of NASA's lead engineers testing new rocket technology.
In order to prove that it's strong enough to survive launch, they build this structural test article, send it to us, we install it in the test stand. We do tests, which involves using hydraulic cylinders to apply loading to it.
Historian Brian Odom says it's just one piece of the larger space launch system, which will launch a new Orion capsule into space.
So the work you see in the background is for the liquid oxygen, the oxidizer for that SLS vehicle, to see if it's going to be able to withstand those pressures, those intense dynamics at launch. And so we're making sure that our models are correct, and so far everything's looking good.
Once testing of these rocket stages is complete here at the Marshall Space Flight Center, the goal isn't just to return astronauts to orbit from Cape Canaveral. There are far greater goals in mind.
Space Launch System is the only rocket capable of sending a fully equipped Orion, the astronauts, the supplies, and the systems to the moon in one launch and taking us to deep space.
The Flight Center's director, Jody Singer, knows the clock is ticking in a new space race, this time with the Chinese, who also plan to land a crew on the moon in the next decade.
I applaud them. Why would be upset because the Chinese are doing something? They're very, very good at what they do.
Astronaut Al Warden, who piloted the Endeavour Command Module during the 1971 Apollo 15 mission to the moon, believes NASA could partner with the Chinese.
What we need to do is cooperate and do stuff with them instead of looking at them arm's length and being a little standoffish about it, because I think a cooperative program would be much more efficient than the way it's going right now.
Right now, private companies like Boeing and SpaceX are developing vehicles to take astronauts into Earth orbit and the International Space Station, while Jody Singer says NASA's sights are set on new historic milestones.
So we're all working very hard to land the first woman and the next man on the moon by 2024 and take what we learned and do it and apply to the future missions such as missions to Mars.
The first new moon mission in the Artemis program is tentatively scheduled for next year without a crew. Artemis 2 plans to send astronauts around the moon in 2022, with Artemis 3 touching down on the lunar south pole in 2024. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Huntsville, Alabama.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You will find us on the radio on many great stations around Asia, like Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. We say hello to everyone there who's been listening today. Thanks for tuning in. We also like to let you know that you can find our program online. It's available at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast. If you can't hear VOA Asia live as we stream on VOA Asia Facebook or our website, voanews.com, all you have to do is listen to the download. You can hear it anytime that you like. It's great. We'd also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman. Speaking of great. And our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.